There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you are not one of them.
You want to
keep up the good work, Stephen, and there you have it. There you go.
Hello, this is Desiree for F1Weekly.com. I'm your in-depth correspondent.
Let's go with the qualifying, Steve.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Steve Faub, my co-host. Nasser Hamid will be bringing us Motorsports Mondial in the second part of the show. This is podcast number 341, April 23rd, 2009. Stephen?
This F1 Weekly Podcast brought to you by the Jim Russell Rotax Challenge and Marin Karting. Check them out, you know you want to.
Thank you, Stephen. And of course, we love our Jim Russell Northern California Rotax Challenge. Check them out on the web. On today's program, is Sebastian Bourdais whining too much? Will Kimi go back into a deep slumber? Predictions on Red Bull's form in Bahrain. And of course, Motorsports Mondial with the king himself, Mr. Nasser Hamid. And a special F1 Weekly interview with Derek and Connor Daly. Steve, welcome to the studio. How are you?
Great. How about yourself, Mr. Rogers?
I'm absolutely wonderful. It's a beautiful day here in Northern California.
Roasty and toasty.
Yep, it's been beautiful, but let's just get right to it because they also say that we will finally have some dry, beautiful weather in Bahrain.
What a novel idea. Dry weather in the desert.
Steve, you never know. Qatar MotoGP was canceled and moved on to a Monday. Things happen out there.
Yeah, that's true. We could end up with a sandstorm or who knows what else.
Exactly. So I'm looking forward to it because, you know, some people, you know, Flavio's been going on his rant, but Renault is pretty confident that they've made progress. They've had some bad luck, but if they have a regular race with dry weather, regular tires, and everybody's happy, they're going to finally show their true form because now they'll have the new floors and double diffusers on not only Fernando Alonso's car, but Nelson Piquet Jr. as well. Whether that helps Nelson, well, that's a totally different program, but nevertheless, they'll both have the updates. I think they'll show some pace, and I think Renault will show some progress, unlike some other teams. Now, I'm not sure if Ferrari is going to be bringing the kinetic energy recovery system. I know Felipe Massa is begging for it.
Yeah, I have a hard time with that as far as Renault goes. They looked impressive in qualifying in Japan, in China. Don't know what happened in El Seno, but Fernando certainly looked like he had some pace, basically splitting the two Red Bulls. So Renault Power, the upgrades they were allowed in the off season to their drivetrain appears to have given them a little bit more of a boost. In fact, the fact that Fernando wasn't running his Kerr system in China and qualified as well as he did says a lot for what their cars is let. And I don't know what you mean by regular tires, because they're Bridgestones, which means you're going to probably get one good set and one crappy set, and you got to figure out how you're going to live with that.
That's true. And some people complain about the tires, but you know what? Everybody has the same tires.
Yep.
So it makes no sense.
And then Felipe begging for Kurs. I'm not surprised, because his car was faster with it than it was without it.
Exactly. Bourdais coming out again. And he did this last year, and I cut him some slack last year. The car wasn't suiting his style, and he was hoping to be signed on for 2009 because he says, you know, he has a lot of experience on slicks, probably the most experienced driver on the grid right now with slick experience.
Slicks on a road course, he's probably got the most experience of anybody, except they run slicks in GP2, do they not?
They do.
So most of the kids that have just come up have got some
the children.
But not nearly as a long period of experience as he does, but he's also used to running two tire compounds too.
I agree, but just a couple of days ago he comes out and he says the STR4 is not suiting his style.
Let me see. Sebastian, yeah, you're a professional race car driver.
Well,
get in the car and drive.
Exactly. Now, Nasser has taped into the studio, and if there's anybody out there who knows about the cage rattling, it's Mr. Nasser Amini. Nasser, welcome.
Good evening, sir. Hello to everybody. How are you?
I'm good. Your thoughts on Bourdais complaining a little bit too much? Alain Prost came out and said, this guy's whining, and he's a French guy.
Well, you know, Bourdais and Piquet Jr. are in a tight situation.
Are they in a pickle?
Well, you know, if you look at their previous achievements, four championships here, British Championship victory for Piquet, these are not bad drivers. I mean, these are very good. That's why they are in Formula One. But, you know, they're in a situation where the teams and the environment is just not going to allow any incubation period. You come there, you perform, or, to borrow a phrase from Derek Daly, get out if you can't do it. So I feel sorry for them, but, you know, that's motor racing.
And, I like the incubation period analogy. Yeah. Very, very good stuff there, Nasser.
Don't count your chickens before they're hatched, right?
Keep up the good work.
A poulet, I should say.
Exactly. So, yeah, I think Bourdais needs to just be quiet. And I don't think he should be talking like this to the press. That kind of conversation you do with your wife, perhaps.
Or your buddies over a couple beers, you know, in your basement. You don't want to put that in the press because, one, you're going to piss off your team principal because you're basically going, my car's junk and it's not working for me. He doesn't want to hear that. He wants you to get out there and make it happen. And the fact that he says it doesn't suit his style, okay, then that pretty much means no F1 car is going to suit his style. So he's pretty much SOL either way.
And this is just like the scenario with Speed and Liuzzi. You know, the team made it very well known through the media that we don't want these drivers. So it's unfair how they're treating him. But then again, you know, this business is all about performance. When you have a 20-year-old kid scoring twice in two races, that's what it's all about. I mean, it's like this, Clark. Like when Mika Hakkinen was given a chance, he out-qualified Senna, right? Whether it meant anything or not, but it made a lot of press and still does. Here we are talking about it. Just imagine if they put Grosjean for a race. And just as a scenario, what if he out-qualifies Alonso? What will that say for Grosjean and for
What is it going to say for Piquet?
Yeah, exactly.
Basically, dude, what have you been doing back there? Having coffee every time you're going on a track?
And I have a feeling that's what's going to happen. Not that he will out-qualify Alonso, but he's not going to be, you know, going out in Q3.
Yeah, so there you have it. I mean, Sebastian Buemi, they gambled on a young talent, and it's paid off. He's done phenomenally well, including in the wet. And when you could perform in the wet, you're really going to make your bosses happy.
But I must say, you know, even if you're the best, if the team does not support you, you're not going to make it. So I think that Bourdais, A, is not feeling he's getting the support, and he may not be up to par with Buemi or Sebastian Vettel. But, you know, it's just not working out for him.
Yeah. We'll see what happens in the next coming races and when they get to Europe. Hopefully Bourdais will be able to pick up his performance, and we'll give them the benefit of the doubt. Let's move quickly to Kimi Raikkonen, one of your favorite drivers. Used to be a love affair, but he seems to be sleeping a lot.
Tainted love.
He's already written off the season. Ferrari is already talking about focusing on the 2010 car, and we're only three races into 17. Steven, your thoughts on the Ferraris?
Yeah, it seems odd to me that they would give up so quickly. I know that they haven't scored yet, but, you know, this is one of the premier teams in the business. They could easily get a diffuser on the back end of this car and get some pace back. They've got probably two of the top six drivers on the grid racing for them. There's nothing that would stop them from possibly running off a string of, you know, three or four podiums in a row with a couple of wins thrown in, and they're right back in it. I don't really understand them giving up already, or at the very least, put up some face and don't give up until halfway through this. Don't tell anybody you're giving up. At least put up some face till you're halfway through the season. If I'm Tifosi, I'm pissed.
Okay, and the Italian press is ripping into them. And to me, I'm stunned because, you know what? You go to the DNF chapel, you throw in a couple of prayers, and Braun could have a few DNFs. All the top teams could have a few DNFs, and that changes everything. So Ferrari should have a little more chutzpah, Nasser?
Yeah, you know, I was looking at the 79 season, which is, what, like 30 years ago. Ligier won the first two races, and then they were nowhere when it came time for the championship. So, I mean, this is a good start for Braun, but it's not, you know, we still have a lot of races to go.
Exactly. There are like 15, 16 more races to go. So you can't give up yet. And then we've also, they've already started to fall back. You look at the way the Red Bulls ran in China.
Yeah,
the door's still open.
Well, the competition is going to catch up to Braun. There is no question about it. Now, it really will, Button, I probably will think, will be, he drove a very smart race. You know, anytime you can finish in bad conditions like in China and pick up. I was thinking yesterday, you know, it was probably 8 points, but at least 6 points that Vettel threw away in the first race. And I'm not saying it was his fault, and also I'm not saying it was Kubica's fault. But those 6 points may come back to haunt him very badly with a race or two to go at the end of the season.
I agree. And let's not forget, Jenson Button is no newcomer to Formula One. And when you have a seasoned driver like him, Rubens Barrichello, and of course the cerebral powerhouse of Ross Brawn on the pit wall, they're going to make good decisions. It's inevitable. He knows what to do. And that's what's lacking at Ferrari. And the other thing is David Coulthard came out and said that what Ferrari needs now is a Fernando Alonso who helps the team develop and shows leadership, which they don't have right now. I mean, Felipe Massa, don't get me wrong, I think he's a great guy, but he's certainly not the team leader Michael Schumacher was. And since Felipe Massa looked up to Michael tremendously, Kimi Raikkonen, who replaced Michael Schumacher, doesn't have those kinds of skills. He comes in, he drives, he's fast, he's gone. Ice cream, Coca-Cola. So I think they're in big trouble on the pit wall, in the driver's seat, and I think it's Spaghetti Junction all over again.
Well, Massa almost won the championship last year, so they can get the job done with Massa.
They can.
If the package is correct.
But there was still a little bit of jaunt lingering in the back. It takes time to destroy a championship-winning team. It doesn't happen overnight. But they're doing it, a very good job of it. And trust me, Felipe Massa, his last chance for a world championship was last year. It's never going to happen again.
You know, that's what I used to think about Nigel Mansell.
Nigel Mansell!
You never know in this business. I mean, Ferrari's only problem, they don't have a competitive package. And it was obvious before the season started that somebody will get it very right, somebody will not. So if they can, you know, tweak this thing and get it going, they at least have one driver that I can count on who will give everybody a run for the money, Mr. Massa.
I agree.
How things change. And as far as Raikkonen is concerned, I don't know what has happened there, but it's they should really... you know, make him a test driver or something, or in charge of the gelato production.
Yeah, and the other thing to take into account for this season, too, is that one of the races only got paid half points. So we've really only had 2.5 races, not really 3 full races. So there's another bit of window that's still open to any team that hasn't scored or scored greatly yet. In the team, look at Braun. Braun really has 1.5 races worth of points instead of 2 full races worth. So,
well, you look at Vettel, okay, how many points is he behind Button? 11, 12, something like that?
Something like that.
If he wins 2 races in a row and Button has a DNF, boom, he's leading the championship. Things can change very quickly, as we have seen in the last 2 races 2 years ago.
Exactly. Real quick question. How many TVs has Di Montezemolo broken so far? Steven?
3.
Yes?
4.
Excellent.
3 from this year, 1 from last year.
There you go. It's a trick question, Steve. There you go. Okay, let's move on. We're going to Bahrain this weekend, dry weather. How do you see, let's talk about a little bit of predicting, how do you see the Red Bull Renaults performing? They don't have the diffuser. Now the Renaults do. People are starting to pick up the slack, including McLaren. Yeah. Even though Hamilton said he was very disappointed with his China performance because he had a number of spins. It wasn't the Rainmeister that we were used to. Vettel was the Rainmeister. And
I think if Lewis has one more race under his belt with the new diffuser, he's not slipping and sliding like he was in China. I think the car was handling differently than he was used to because of the extra downforce in the back, and that was kind of messing up his touch. Like you say, McLaren's coming up. They're going to probably be competitive this weekend if they get their full-blown diffuser in place by this weekend. Renault's stepping up. You know, the only thing that comes to mind that scares me with Red Bull is that it is the old Jaguar team. And Jaguar's always had trouble with overheating. You know, Red Bulls haven't had any problems. It's kind of an old bias. But, you know, it's hard to say what's going to happen in the desert. And then if we get any kind of blowing dust, it's going to kind of throw everything out the window because it's going to still be a little bit slippery.
Nasser?
It would be nice to see Red Bull be as competitive as they were in China. And we'll see. But I don't think McLaren, Lewis Hamilton will push and shove. I mean, that's for sure. But I don't think they have McLaren or Ferrari have the package right now. Maybe another 2-3 races.
Let's go to BMW. I think a big disappointment for all BMW fans at this stage. Even Mario Tyson has agreed, even though he has liked the shakeup in Formula 1 with the new rules, but also disappointed that they haven't shown any performance. Kurz really hasn't helped Kubica at all. Nick Heidfeld, obviously, he's got to perform outstandingly all season long because his career is going to be over. Where do you see BMW this weekend?
That's a good question because they look pretty good in Australia. Kubica was on his way to a podium before he and Vettel, you know, had a little run-in. They didn't look very impressive in Malaysia. They kind of like, where'd they go? And then in China, they were again kind of missing in action. So it's hard to say what we're going to see from them this week. If, you know, maybe they can step up. I don't know where they are at on getting their trick diffuser or their double diffuser going. And then I thought that they were going to have both cars with Kurz, but it didn't appear that both cars had Kurz. So I say lower high pack for basically probably in the 8 to 10 range on the grid for them. I don't see them getting much higher than that just because everybody else is kind of surging forward and they're not jumping to the fore.
What about Toyota? The team to watch, really doing well in qualifying, but the Jarno Trulli train keeps showing up. And it's bizarre. I mean, great qualifying form. And that, I mean, I know it was a wet race, and we'll see what happens in Bahrain, but still. It
should make a difference in Bahrain. But you know what I'd really like to see Toyota do is put him on a Q3 quali track with a light tank. Get him out in front and give him some speed so that he can kind of get away from people because Toyota so often loads him up, but he ends up going out in the 7th, 8th position, and that just kills him.
You mean the tankard effect?
Yeah.
No, I noticed that too, but Timo Glock has been doing a pretty good job.
Pretty solid. Who I really want to see step up is Nico Rosberg. He's been having fantastic practice sessions, and then kind of fades in quality, and then kind of fades a little bit more once we get into the race.
And speaking of Williams, they are in dire need of a win. I believe their last win was Juan Pablo Montoya 2004 in Brazil. That's a long time ago.
And Nico apparently likes this track. If we go back to his rookie season when he basically set fastest lap, blew everybody away.
And I remember how excited we were. I mean,
but he was on his way to Ferrari next season.
And it's funny how, I mean, I still think he's a great driver, but obviously, as the king says, no package, no delivery. And apparently Williams, even though they seem so close, and that great start that Nico had at the beginning of the season, they've showed pace. They just can't keep it up.
And the other thing that's kind of confused me, too, is Kaz has just kind of completely fallen off the map.
He's inconsistent as hell.
Last season, he was pretty much keeping up with Nico, out-qualified him once or twice. This season, so far, he's been in the back partying with Kimi.
Well, I think Nico is a good, steady, consistent driver who's working well with the team. I think Kaz is suffering a little bit. I think he's being rattled, Nasser.
Well, you know, I wish him well, but, you know, when he came into Formula 1, he, I believe, had never even won a race in GP2. And I remember he finished fourth in the championship, exactly half the points of Timo Glock. And nobody equates Timo Glock with Senna or Schumacher. So, judging by those things, courtesy of Toyota engine in the back, he's in the cockpit, doesn't mean he's a bad driver. But I don't think he's Formula 1 material, is my personal opinion.
Bernie Eggleston told Bruno Senna to don't get committed to anything, and therefore he decided not to go into DTM. Bruno Senna all of a sudden believes, now he's still going to be doing Le Mans with the Orica team, but he believes that there's a good chance that he's going to be replacing one of these drivers we talk about, Bourdais, Piquet, Nakajima. Do you guys see that happening, Steven?
Not really. Most of those teams are committed to the drivers that they have, and they also have drivers in their repertoire. I could see maybe him showing up at Toro Rosso, but why would Flavio put Senna in the seat when he's got Grosjean? And then Toyota's going to kibosh anything that they try to do with Nakajima, I would think.
Yeah, and I don't know, I even read that there's some wild thoughts that he's still hoping to replace Rubens Barrichello, who's been doing a great job. I mean, there's no reason.
Fine, perfectly fine job.
And with limited testing, you need the Rubinhos in there with lots of knowledge on car setup. Nasser?
Well, no guarantees in Formula One for a seat for Bruno Senna or anybody. But I tell you what will be the defining answer to this question. A, how a couple of drivers perform in GP2 this year, especially Grosjean. If he dominates, which he really showed in second year, so that's one less seat for
Bruno.
And if Nico Hülkenberg has a breakout season, and I think he will be the cage rattler this year in his rookie year. He already won his third ever GP2 race in GP2 Asia. So I think the Williams seat is going to go to Nico Hülkenberg. I have a very strong feeling if Nico Rosberg goes. He's already a test driver, and Willy Weber is in his corner. So Bruno Senna has got a tough mountain to climb, just like Liuzzi and Pantano and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and listening to Bernie's like listening to. It's like, okay, Bernie, I won't go. I won't take that job, and I'll sit on my butt and not work probably the entire year, and still probably not going to ride next year. And every year he's out of racing, his opportunities in Formula One are going to shrink. And his opportunities outside of Formula One are going to start to shrink. I don't know that I'd take that kind of advice. If you've got a chance at a drive, get into DTM and dominate and prove that you can race.
But sometimes you get into DTM and then it's hard to get into Formula One, like a Paul de Resta.
You could almost look at like a guy like Sebastian Bourdais, who couldn't get the seat in F1, went to the States and got stuck there for the next 5-6 years.
Exactly. Dominating, but still, nobody's impressed with American sports.
Well, you know, if you want to get into Formula One, you know, traditional route is F3, GP2, and almost everybody has to go through either F3 Euro Series or GP2. I mean, you really have to win 8 or 10 races. It's the thing, you know, anybody can put together a couple of wins. That's not going to get you a seat in Formula One. But if you do 10, 12 wins in British F3 and then you parlay that into 8, 9 wins in GP2, you're in Formula One. It's all performance. Look at Sebastian Vettel and, you know, all these people.
There's timing involved, too. Bruno just was at the right place at the wrong moment. Yeah. For Honda to step away and basically have his seat pulled from him. Ross knows that he doesn't have any testing time to get his car on the track, so he's going to go with the experienced guy he knows can basically help them develop from the seat.
And, you know, our good friend Dr. Miguel has posted on the forum a news item from autosport.pt, Portugal, that Mercedes is thinking, or at least it's rumored to be dropping McLaren for all the problems and buying straight into Braun. They're already supplying engines, so who knows what will happen. So many things, you know, there are so many underlying currents that you don't know which way you will be carried, you know.
Well, Mercedes certainly doesn't like the shenanigans at McLaren from 2007.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just being dragged in the mud. They really don't like that. They see a Braun. I mean, Braun is respected up and down the paddock. Never involved in silly activities. It's just a good name to be associated with.
Not only that, but looking at it at this point in time, Braun is the type of team that could probably turn in, as far as longevity and name on the circuit, that McLaren is today. He could easily parlay that into a long-term deal. If he could get Mercedes on board, it could be Braun GP for the next 10, 15, 20 years.
Not only that, but which I really was surprised, but the sports car department of McLaren, which is going to be run by Ron Dennis, will not involve Mercedes-Benz. Mm. So there are things changing out there, and Mercedes has got some big decisions to make because they are hard pressed in these economic times, just like everybody else. So, quickly before we go to break, the FIA has asked Formula One team principals for their input on whether the £30 million per season budget cap figure announced last month's World Council meeting should be revised. In other words, should they bring it up or bring it down? Some people are completely against the cap. I sort of think it's a pretty good idea. It's the way we run our American football system here, and it seems to have worked because things get out of control without a cap.
Yeah, well, you can basically have unlimited spending, and then the haves, you basically end up with a much larger gap between haves and have-nots. The NFL did it more as a revenue-sharing deal than it did anything else. Same thing goes kind of for hockey, too. I think that the cap needs to be based like it is on, say, hockey, and I believe football to a certain degree, too, is that what are the total revenues of the sport, and then the cap is based, you know, in those other sports, it's a salary cap for the players. But in a little bit different, I would think, in Formula One, but I think it should be based on what is the total available revenue from F1, and then, you know, maybe you give some teams a little bit of leeway for a little extra space because, you know, they've got, you know, more sponsorship than others. But a hard cap I have a hard time with, but some kind of cap, so you don't have a team like Toyota was 2-3 years ago, just splitting literally $500 million and getting nowhere. And, you know, part of it, though, is a lot of the Formula One budgets aren't really directed at the cars. You know, I'm almost guarantee you that probably $100 million of Toyota's money was dedicated to basically marketing and bringing in VIPs and doing those kind of things and not car development.
NAS cap or no cap?
How will they monitor this? You know, here is the thing, you're talking about Toyota or Mercedes. These big auto manufacturers, they can do a lot of research and development. How are you going to monitor that?
Yeah, so you could easily run stuff in a lab, you know, off in Nova Scotia, and nobody would know that you were doing it.
Yeah, and, you know, but, you know, all these things they have done on engine freeze and other regulations, spec tires and this and that. You know, it's all a function of time and environment we are in. Once the economy is rolling and there's a lot of money coming into the sport, then, you know, it will go back to not where it was, but maybe close to it. So it's a demand and supply thing.
Thank you, Nasser. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Motorsports Mondial after this brief message.
Hi, I'm Clark Rogers, host of F1Weekly.com's podcast. Please visit our website, F1Weekly.com, your fresh new destination for all your Formula One needs. F1Weekly.com brings you a weekly podcast that covers the latest news, rumors, and insightful commentary related to the pinnacle of modern motorsports, Formula One. You can find us on iTunes and other popular podcast locations. F1Weekly.com. Thank you.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial and the man himself, Mr. Nasser Hamid. Nas, welcome back to the studio. How are you?
Very good, sir. Thank you. I do notice tea, mint tea, is now being served in a new Big Dog System cup. Thank you, Mr. Favre. Service is improving here.
Excellent.
Okay, here we go. Greetings and racing regards from the land of milk and honey to the land of fortune cookie. A young man is singing in the rain in Shanghai, and a grown man is talking trash, but his garbage is not going down the drain very well. Flavio Briatore is the subject of this week's Motorsports Mantra. May I proceed with your express written consent, sir?
Absolutely, sir. Proceed.
Even though it's affecting the head man of Renault.
That's fine, because Flavio can say a lot of things that don't necessarily mean Renault was saying it, and people get confused, but he's an eccentric individual, and you know what? He's got a number of world championships under his belt, and he can say whatever he wants.
Okay, good. These are not happy times for effervescent Flavio. His competitive flame has been diffused, first by the FIA in declaring the double-decker diffusers legal. Then there is the case of his protege, Nelsinho Piquet, who has his dad's name but not the talent that made him a three-time world champion. Flavio, a billionaire who made millions in Benetton clothing line, team and driver management, and other business ventures, is now taking a cheap shot and calling for revenue due to Honda F1 team be divided among all teams except Braun Racing. Teams using the double-decker diffusers apart from Braun are Toyota, still looking for first winning bite after serving over $2 billion in their F1 campaign, and Williams, as you said, winless since Monty in Brazil 2004. The Big Three and other teams, some with much deeper engineering and F1 know-how, who missed the diffuser mixer, will now have to fight back to the front, which is the essence of motor racing anyway. Advantages, fair and unfair, are gained from time to time. They may be in the form of, pay attention, Mr. Rogers, they may be in the form of mass dampers, tires that expand after passing pre-race scrutineering, like in Hungary 2003, or you may have advantages which lead to allegation, and here I repeat the word lead to allegations, I'm not sure if they are true, allegations of illegal traction control software on the car or illegal modifications to the refueling rig for faster delivery. Sounds familiar, Signor Flavio? So for all the complaining about the team that has outfoxed the fox and outran the rabbit and calling championship leader slow as a signpost, despite trying to hire him for 2009, no bravo bravo for Flavio, only basura basura. And that was this week's Motorsports Mantra.
Thanks for an outstanding mantra. Make some good points there, but I'm still a Flavio fan, and it's only three races into the season. I'm not going to Kim this.
Time will tell, sir. Clock is ticking.
Exactly. So I still think Renault has a chance.
Well, I would like to see them win. I'd like to see Toyota win. We want all these teams to have some success so they stay in the business.
Absolutely. I'd like to see Williams win.
Yeah, absolutely.
That would be
absolutely
exciting.
But the team that's really threatening is, apart from Red Bull, they've already got one, is Toyota. And I hope Trulli gets one or Glock, and it'll be good for the sport.
It would be good, but I don't see Trulli winning again for the rest of his life.
Okay. Now we go from morning to motor racing on the track. World Series by Renault, season opener in Barcelona. Both races were won by Marcos Martinez. Australian V8 from Hamilton in New Zealand, race 1, Jamie Wincup over Mark Winterbottom, also known as Frosty. Race 2 had the same flavor. Wincup was the winner again, this time over James Courtney. Maybe they should call Kimi Raikkonen Frosty.
He's definitely Frosty in more ways than one.
Okay. This was a surprise for me. 2009 Race of Champions. This year's event will take place during the week at Bird's Nest in Beijing, and it will start 2 days after the Formula One season finale in Abu Dhabi. And Frederick Johnson, who is Michel Mouton's partner, and you know these people arranged this thing, he's saying that the event will get back to Europe, you know, pretty soon. So let's see what happens.
They probably got a real deal on using the birdcage, because my understanding was they were having a hard time finding events for the venue since the Olympics.
Yeah, right. I mean, go ahead.
It's a nice venue. I happen to like it quite a bit.
It's very impressive, and so is the Shanghai International Circuit. But what if nobody's going? You know, I read a story on GrandPrix.com by Mike Dootson, and it's just one of those things. You know, they're building all these magnificent tracks, and there is hardly any interest or capacity of the average person to get to the track because of ticket prices.
The government just needs to hand out free tickets. That's the best thing to do. Yeah.
And or do more marketing to get people excited and interested in going to the races.
Yeah, but you know, it's like trying, I mean, look what happened to football in the United States. They brought in David Beckham, Pele, still, you know, people are still interested in NFL and baseball. So it's like trying to build a $100 million stadium for cricket. Yeah, all the homies will show up, and the Brits and Aussies, but I don't think, you know, many people will show up with a hot dog looking for a wicked googly, you know.
Absolutely.
Okay, Indy Racing League, they were in the streets of Long Beach, one of the very well-established street races of the United States. Dario Franchitti winning on wife Ashley Judd's 19th birthday, so congratulations to both. But we may have to do a fact check on if this was Ashley's 19th or maybe there was another digit before.
Maybe nine. It was her 3rd, 4th, 29th birthday.
Okay. Pole sitter Will Power was 2nd, Tony Kanaan 3rd, Danica Patrick 4th, and Dan Weldon 5th. Elio Castro Neves was 7th, and his return puts Will Power on the sidelines, but he will drive for Penske at Indy. The guy in the third Penske car was in pole position, and this is what you need to do to get, you know, create excitement about somebody hiring you. So we wish him all the best. Indy Lights, a big win for young American talent from Sausalito, which is not far from the palatial studios of F1 Weekly, and the winner was J.R. Hildebrand. Nice kid, and a pretty good racer too. American Le Mans Series, they were also running around the streets of Long Beach. Have you ever been to the Long Beach Grand Prix?
No, I have not.
Really? Mr. Favre?
No, me neither.
Okay. 1-2-3 for Acura. First win for DeFerrari Racing with team owner and Simon Pagenaud winning over David Brabham and Scott Sharp. Dos Amigos, Adrian Fernandez and Luis Diaz were third. And now some Alexander Rossi update, another young American talent from Northern California. He won the, you know, last year Formula BMW Americas Championship and the World Finals in Mexico. And this past week, he was in Czech Republic testing a Formula Master car at Brno. And if anybody wants to look at the Formula Master website, it's formulamaster.net, not .com. And Rossi was fourth fastest on day one and seventh on day two, which is pretty impressive showing against experienced drivers in first time on the track. Now we come to Clark Rogers' favorite series, NASCAR. Cup race in Dry Heat, Phoenix, Arizona was won by ageless Mark Martin, a quality gentleman from Batesville, Arkansas.
How did Juan Pablo Montoya do?
I don't know.
He circles around. He doesn't even check anymore.
Yeah. I mean, you know, but the thing is, you know, you watch a race, he's running second. 20 laps later, he's, you know, 38.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, caution, lucky dog, and, you know, scribble porcupine. They have all these things I can't follow. But I do watch it, you know, when I'm home, and I'm always interested in
He does not seem to be very competitive in NASCAR. I rarely ever see him running at the front. He's usually either between the 15th place and the 35th place. Whenever I look, same kind of thing for Scott Speed, too. They're usually always back in the pack.
Yeah, but again, like most racing series, there are only two or three teams that keep winning. I mean, just look how long Dale Jr. has gone without winning a lot of races, and, you know, Jeff Gordon has gone a year without a win.
How old is Mark Martin? Like, 78? And he wins this race? What does that say?
And he's not with one of the big teams, is he?
I don't know. I think he's with Hendrick.
I
don't know. I mean, they keep, you know, first he was retired, then he was with Chevy, then he was with somebody else.
And now he's racing a limited schedule, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, it's just, he's up there in age.
Yeah, he's only doing like 12 events this year or something like that.
But, you know, good for him. And he's a good guy. He's always come across as a nice guy. Was with Ford for a long, long time. Okay, now I have some notes on the Chinese Grand Prix. You know, when Sebastian Vettel won, it was 1-2. First time they won it, 1-2, just like the Kubica Heidfeld in Montreal.
Yeah.
Montreal last year, right? Yeah. And so I went down today all the list, and you know, it's amazing. You know, we make mistakes, we're only human. And I have a friend who buys the auto course here every year. And I kid you not, every year when he gets a copy, he says to me, Nas, I've only gone to the first 4 pages or 10 pages and already discovered a couple of mistakes. Okay? I have a DVD. It is about the 73 Formula One season, which, you know, was the first season I started following. So I watched it again and again all the time. Actually, I was watching it last night a little bit also. And I think it's the Italian Grand Prix. It has to be Italian because Peterson was first and Emerson Fittipaldi second. And they said that, you know, Team Lotus had won 50 races at that time, but this was their first 1-2, which I thought was very impressive. And today I started looking into, I went through the F1 Formula One website and I checked every race, and I hope I did it correctly. Turns out that's not correct. So here we have some famous 1-2. I again need your express written consent, please.
Please continue, and of course, these are correct.
No, I'm human. I'm human too.
To the best of our knowledge.
Yeah, and efforts. Okay, the very first Formula One Grand Prix, the British at Silverstone in 1950, saw Alfa Romeo drivers dominate the podium. Since then, some teams have opened their score with a 1-2 finish. And the interesting thing about this race at Silverstone, Ferrari did not take part in this race. Scuderia Ferrari, that is. In 1954, Mercedes marked their return to Grand Prix racing by taking the top spots of the podium in the French Grand Prix. Fangio and German driver Karl Kling were the drivers. It was not until the 1968 Dutch Grand Prix that we had another 1-2 to mark maiden win for a team. This time it was the beautiful blue Matra of Jackie Stewart and one-time meat delivery driver, and these are his own words, by the name of Jean-Pierre Beltoise, who was second. And I'm in touch with some people I know in Europe who know Beltoise. I'm trying to get to him for an extended interview next month because I hope to be there in your fantasy land for the Le Mans and all that kind of stuff. But more on that later. 3 decades later, and in high drama at Spa, and I believe you were at this race, right?
1998.
Belgian Grand Prix?
One of my favorites.
Cool. Damon Hill led a 1-2 to give Eddie Jordan his first win in Formula One. Hill's teammate was Ralph Schumacher, but it was his brother, the full Monty Michael, who made all the headlines by decimating the field in the deluge, only to run into the back of DC and his McLaren. And I was recently reading an article interview with DC, and of course you remember, you can see this on YouTube, Michael marched to the McLaren.
Oh, it was exciting. It was NASCAR-esque.
Exactly. And DC in this interview says that a few weeks later or a few races later, he tried to patch things up with Michael and went to talk to him. And he said, Mike, basically what he was saying is that Michael was a complete butthead. And he said, just would not see his point of view. So DC asked him, have you ever been wrong in your racing career? And Michael says, no. So he said, I asked him, have you ever been wrong in your life? And Michael says, no. So there you have it. At least he was consistent.
No, I like that.
Yeah. Okay. Another decade would go by before Kubica and Heidfeld would bring their ultimate driving machines to a 1-2 finish in Montreal last year. And this year we have in China the talented and F1's latest cage rattler, Mr. Vettel, leaving his mark on Weber by leading a Red Bull 1-2 only 7 months after giving sister ship Toro Rosso their long-awaited maiden win at Monza last year. Both were very impressive, I must say. All I can say is, mach's gut, junger Mann. And I'm going to tell you something about, you know, I've mentioned this a couple of times, that Vettel's performance at Monza showed the difference between him and Kovalainen, who was on the front row. I'll tell you, I do feel sorry for Mark Webber, because I think he's a pretty good driver. He's a good guy, always comes, always available to the media. And, you know, it's one of those things, you know, you sacrifice anything and everything, you break your leg, come back to Formula One after all these teams and all these years you've driven for, you finally get a winning package, and you got a cage rattler as a teammate.
Exactly. And you've got probably the top three fastest guy on the grid in the car next to you.
Yeah, he's rare talent. And this is the same thing happened to poor Elio De Angelis. He was in his like fifth year of Lotus, playing second fiddle to Nigel Mansell, hoping he'll be number one, get all the, you know, goodies and all the best engineers. And in walks in Ayrton Senna da Silva. Party was over, opening round. But that's the way. That's this business, you know. You got to make the most. It's like, you know, going back to the days when Michael had the best package. Well, you know, do the best you can. Otherwise, you know, like you said about Massa, quite a few people out there think he may not get that opportunity. And unless you're in a very competitive car, nobody wins, including you-know-who. Yes, yes, say no more. Okay, now, this is interesting. We're going to look at some drivers who gave three different teams their first Grand Prix victory. And in all the broadcasts I heard, I was really disappointed that Dan Gurney's name was not mentioned, and we'll show you why. Okay, these are drivers who gave three different teams their first win, which will start with Sir Stirling Moss. He gave Vanwall their first win in a shared drive with Tony Brooks at Aintree in 1957. His 1958 victory in Argentina was the first for Cooper and also the first for a rear-engine car. And in 1960 Monaco Grand Prix, he gave Lotus Cars their first win. Car was entered by Rob Walker Racing. Team Lotus had to wait till the first Watkins Glen Grand Prix in 1961 to score their maiden win. And actually, I believe Rob Walker entered Lotus one, two, or three races before Lotus was able to get a win on their own. But they had Stirling Moss, so it makes a difference. Dan Gurney, the ever-smiling gentleman from Newport Beach, California, gave Porsche their one and only win at Rouen in the 1962 French Grand Prix. 2 years later, at the same track, he recorded Brabham's first win and in 1967 flew his own eagle to victory at Spa. Very, very impressive. Jackie Stewart, his winning contribution saw Matra in Holland 1968, March in the car march, or the team march, I should say, in Spain 1970, and Tyrrell again in Spain the following year. All recorded their first win courtesy of the wee bit safety conscious Scottish driver. So all these people have a lot of historical contribution to motor racing. In an interesting side note, this is what I was talking earlier, the first 1-2 for Team Lotus was in the 1967 US Grand Prix at Watkins Glen. Jim Clark over Graham Hill. And before we get to our interview segment, come to a segment called Lap Ahead, where we look at upcoming events this weekend. One is for Formula One, so Bahrain Grand Prix from BIC, Bahrain International Circuit. A is for Argentina, that's where the WRC boys will be in action. G is for Grand Am, NASCAR Sports Car Series in action at Virginia International Raceway. I for IndyCars at Kansas Speedway. Wonder if there will be dust in the wind. You know that song, right?
One of my favorites.
Very good. You have quite a few favorites like me. That's good. M is for MotoGP and Motegi in Japan. And N can only be for NASCAR. Boys will be in Sweet Home, Alabama at Talladega, where the PBR is blue and the government is true. Or so they say.
Keep up the good work, Nasser. Thank you for another outstanding Motorsports Mondial. And now stay tuned for the interviews after this brief message.
You are listening to F1 Weekly. We invite you to visit our forum page. Topics range from Fangio to Fisico and from baked beans to racing scene.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now for another special F1Weekly.com interview. And now we're talking about a father and son reunion. Nass, please introduce these two gentlemen.
Yes, sir. Thank you. This is with Derek Daly and Connor Daly. Derek is the dad and Connor is the young American kid. Derek Daly made it, you know, names like Derek Daly takes me back to the, for me, the golden era of motor racing, the early 70s, when I started following this beautiful sport. So Derek Daly made it to Formula One on the Devo program, worked in iron ore mines of Australia to go motor racing, raced with Williams and Tyrrell in Formula One, and then raced for many years in IndyCars. He is now based in Indianapolis, and his company, Derek Daly Design, is involved in designing racetracks around the world. And I would encourage our listeners to check out his website, which is www.derekdalydesign.com. The second part of the interview is with his son, Connor. Connor is 17 years old, and after a winning career in karting, he is now rapidly climbing the single-seater ladder. In 2008, he won the Skip Barber Championship with 5 wins. Representing Team USA, also won the Walter Hayes Formula Ford 1600 trophy at Silverstone. This year, he's taking part in Star Mazda Series, and his website is www.connordaily.net. And Connor is spelled C-O-N-O-R in his case. My sincere thanks to Derek. I really enjoyed talking to him and to his son Connor. And I want to thank them again for their time at Sebring, which is where this conversation took place. Thank you.
Okay, folks, I'm here with Derek Daly, a gentleman who went to Australia to work in coal mines to go motor racing. And I love that story. Tell us a little bit about that, please.
It was a case back then where you just did whatever you had to do to get a chunk of cash if you wanted to buy a racing car. And I heard about an opportunity. I could either go to the iron ore mines in Australia or the oil fields of Alaska. The choice to go to the iron ore mines was made because we had to spend £1,000 for clothing to keep us warm in Alaska, and they were going to take that out of our pay pack. And we thought, nah, that's no good. We need all the money. So we just cut the legs off our pants and cut the sleeves off our shirts, and we were perfectly dressed for working in the mines in Australia.
How long were you there?
6 months of the winter of 73-74.
And how much of 6 months of coal mine, working in the mine brought you in terms of racing time?
Well, what it allowed me to do is I came back with £5,000, which in those days was $10,000. And I'd never seen that amount of money before. And so that allowed me to buy a Formula Ford, which put me on the track to winning the Irish Formula Ford Championship. Then I had a valuable championship-winning car, which I sold. Got reasonable money for that, and was going to be able to use that for the following season, which was 76, in England. And I had enough money to either race or to live, but I really couldn't do both at the same time. So to live, I just bought an old school bus, took all the seats out of it, put two ramps in the back, and ran the racing car into the middle of it, and I had a toolbox, a racing car, and a sleeping bag, and my mother made curtains for the bus. My dad made a sponge mattress, and I said goodbye to my family, and that was it. I went to England to become a professional.
And you made it to Formula One. What was the highlight for you in your Formula One days?
I suppose the highlight was, making it that far, because I came from such a basic non-motorsports background. Events like the British Grand Prix, I finished fourth in the Tyrrell. I can still remember some of the corners in that car. Driving the Williams, places like Monaco, leading Monaco in 1982, about to start the last lap, gearbox broke. That's pretty heady times to live through for someone who came from the background I came from. And then just to have the ability to mix with those type of people, really people that you thought were on a different level until you got there. And then, of course, I went to the Indy 500 because I was intrigued by this racing at 200 miles an hour between a concrete wall. It just didn't make sense to me, and the speeds were so high. I went there in 83 for curiosity, and I never left. I've been there ever since.
Now, is Formula One really as intense, and it is what it is, as you hear while you're climbing the ladder?
It is, without a doubt, the most intense class of racing on the planet. Formula One has this ability to put pressure on you just by its very existence. It is so results driven that you automatically are pressured to get a result no matter what the circumstances. And that type of pressure, I think you have to learn to absorb it, live with it, understand it, potentially use it to your advantage. But without a doubt, it is the most pressure-filled sporting environment in the world that flushes out every strength and every weakness in every person on the team, not just the drivers.
Is Patrick Head really a knucklehead that you read in the reports?
Well, Patrick Head is one of those geniuses. He is one of those people who quietly thinks levels deeper than most people. He wants to know why it works, and how he can come up with a better, more efficient way to make it work. And he is fueled by this almost driver-like desire to succeed. I mean, after all these years, he doesn't need any money anymore. But after all these years, he's still fueled with this great desire to innovate, to develop, to prove, and really to again wave the flag of what he and Frank as privateers now can do together. And that, I mean, that desire, I think, to dedicate your life to that is part of what is part of what Formula One is. It's a lifestyle. It's not a job. It's a lifestyle.
How was Frank to deal with?
Frank was a very black and white person. Frank had no time for the emotion of the moment. Very businesslike, black and white. Really didn't understand that certain environments bring out the best in certain people. It was come in, work, do it right, or get out. There's plenty more people to come and take your place. which is understandable. Some drivers flourished in that environment. Some drivers didn't. And I think Frank is still the same today. He's still black and white. Still doesn't understand. For example, when Frentzen went there, Frentzen needed a bit of emotional support to get the best from him. Frank wasn't prepared to give that to him because he didn't understand what it meant. And Frentzen almost, his career almost died at Williams. He goes to Jordan the next year and he almost wins the world championship. So he had the talent, he just didn't have the environment.
Now, I remember you from your days with the Renault car, Renault garage door in IndyCar racing, and you had a big accident. What were the highlights for you in your IndyCar? And how much did you enjoy oval racing compared to Formula One circuit?
Believe it or not, oval track racing was a bit of a strange animal because, in a way, racing on an oval, particularly a short oval, with a really good handling car, was what you thought racing always should be. High speed, slipstreaming, passing, being passed, high action all the time. It's what you imagined racing would be. Road racing, at the levels I did it, is so fast, the cars are so stiff, they're so abrupt, they're so abrasive, they're actually hostile environments. They're physically difficult animals to drive. So oval track racing had this, just this satisfaction feel when the car was good. Now, on the other hand, when the car was bad, it was by far the scariest, unnerving, most dangerous environment you could ever put an athlete into, without a doubt. And I got to experience both sides of what that looks like.
What is your homeboy Eddie Irvine doing these days?
Growing his hair long, doing as little as possible, getting out of bed as late as possible, chasing as many women as possible, counting his money as often as possible. Looking cool and trying to prove to everybody that he could have been world champion if Michael Schumacher never existed.
Yeah, quite a few people can say that. Formula One season is about to start. I want you to give me settle this debate. People think Hamilton, and I asked Stirling Moss the same question, that Hamilton is, you know, spoon-fed success, everything worked out for him. How would you rate him as a race car driver?
Well, first of all, let me tell you, I'm a big fan of Eddie Irvine's. And I'll tell you what his greatest strength was, his mental strength. He absolutely mentally had it over most of his competitors. So, Hamilton, is he spoon-fed? I don't know. I don't really care. Because the beauty about motor racing is, even if you're handed everything on a plate, there is nowhere to hide when you have to go perform. When you're asked by yourself to get in, go perform, the eyes of the world are on you, all your strengths and weaknesses come out. So it doesn't matter what Lewis Hamilton had supposedly handed to him, and he had a good development path. Without a doubt, he is true world-class material that is potentially a model for so many people to follow. I love what he's done. I love what he's brought to the sport. And the level of intrigue that he has brought has replaced the level of intrigue that Michael Schumacher left when he walked away.
Who do you think will win this year, and who would you like to see win the championship this year?
The beauty about Formula One is you never know what's going to happen. After recent testing, who would believe that Jenson Button might win a race? He might win three or four races. If he wins three or four or five races, he might be world champion with a new rule they just instigated. If you look at past history, I have a sneaky suspicion that BMW are going to be even stronger this year. They just have a measured, controlled approach that they seem to execute at a level as high, if not higher, than some teams. I can't imagine that Ferrari without Schumacher will continue to be as technically advanced as they need to be. Ron Dennis has given up leadership at McLaren. I don't know whether that will affect them or not. So when you look at all that and look what Ross Brawn is about to produce, don't you think the intrigue of Formula One next year might be greater at a higher level than ever before? And will Alonso package it? And they say he's the safest hands in Formula One. You know, will he package a season-long ability to bring another world championship for him? I actually don't know, but it sure is a great amount of intrigue.
You must be a very proud papa these days. Your son Connor is doing very well. How much are you involved in guiding his career?
I'm very much involved with guiding Conor's career. I've been there, done that, made all the mistakes. So I try and use my experience to potentially guide him along a path that he tells me he wants to go along. No matter what I can do for him, at the end of the day, it's a bit like Lewis Hamilton. When a driver jumps into the car, he's by himself. So you then look at a driver, does he have... I mean, it's all great fun. Drivers love driving racing. It's great fun. Great to miss school for a week and go to Florida. But at the end of the day, you look at a package that is a driver, and does he have the innate ability that and to have the X factor, that little differentiating X factor that just puts him in a position to succeed, that allows him to rise to the top when it's necessary, to get the momentum, to come on song at the right time. And so far, all through his go-karting and his Formula Ford in Canada and his Skip Barber, he's been able to do that. Now he's at a higher level. The challenge starts all over again. He's immediately fast in the Star Mazda Championship, and we'll see what he learns. We'll see how far he goes. But I do tell him his success in the future will not be dependent upon the team or what I bring or what he brings or what sponsorship brings. It'll actually be on what he himself is prepared to sacrifice, what he learns, what he does, how he applies himself. That will be the ultimate determining factor on how far he goes.
I do want to ask you a question based on a word you use, mistakes. What were some of the big mistakes you made, or what is the most common mistake young drivers make that hurt them in their career?
From what I've experienced with many, many young drivers, very few of them understand the difference between a strength and a weakness. Very few of them would admit that they have a weakness. One of my biggest problems was I never knew I had a weakness. Nobody told me. I never understood it. So, nor would I ever admit it, because I wouldn't want anybody to even think of it. Little did I know, if I identify a weakness, work on it, turn it into a strength, and then add it to my natural strength, you become a powerhouse. And I find the same trends with young drivers today. So I wrote a book that was published about a year ago on driver development. And it's all about understanding the ingredients, understanding how to develop all those ingredients. And if you have weaknesses, which every driver has, work on it, don't bury it, expose it, work on it, develop it, and then you can potentially become the very best you can be. And let's face it, what more could you ask for but to become the very best you can possibly be?
Derek, I really appreciate your time. Finally, how about a message for listeners of F1 Weekly? And I'm very pleased to tell you we have listeners in your country also.
Well, I love the fact that F1 Weekly is on the internet, because you now have access to the world. My family in Ireland can now listen to this. Awesome. So keep listening. Send messages every now and then. Tell your friends to tune in, because you will get information here that few get access to, and it'll be broadcast around the world. I love it.
Thank you very much. Okay, I'm here with a young, happening dude of American motor racing, Conor Daly. Conor, welcome to F1 Weekly. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Excellent.
I remember your dad from his Formula One days, of course, from his IndyCar days. Tell me, motor racing, you know, is it all because your dad is a racing driver? What's your, you know, how deep is your love for motor racing?
Well, motor racing is what I love most. I mean, I've played every other sport in America to do, and motor racing is definitely where my heart is, and it's just what I enjoy doing most, and it's great to have a dad who's been through everything in the motor racing world, and he's a great asset to me.
Now, you were in karting. Tell us about your karting experience, and how long were you in karting?
Well, I did karting for since when I was 10 till about 15 years old. It was a good time. I won a lot of junior championships and won a couple national championships and then just slowly started progressing into the race car world, and that's been where my life's been going ever since.
Now, recently, you and Jeff Newgarden, Jeff or Joseph?
Joseph
Newgarden raced in Europe and had some success at the Formula Ford. Tell us about that. This was at Brands Hatch, right?
It was an incredible experience over there. We got to do the Formula Ford Festival at Brands Hatch and the Walter Hayes Trophy at Silverstone. And it was an amazing experience to go over there as Americans. And usually the Europeans picture us as less talented or you know, not as good as them. So it was good to go over there and Joseph win the festival and me win the Walter Hayes. So it was an incredible experience overall.
Now, up till now, how much single-seater racing have you done in the U.S.?
Well, last year I did the Skip Barber National Championship, and I won that, and that was really my first full year in cars. The year before, I had done some karting and cars, but last year was really my first full year. I also did the Canadian Formula Ford Championship last year, which I finished second, won Rookie of the Year, won six races in a row, the last six. And then now this year will be my first year in the Star Mazda Championship, so should be a good year.
Now, when you moved from karting to single-seater racing, what was the biggest adjustment?
Well, I think the biggest adjustment would be has to be the weight. The weight of the cars is so different to get used to from a small, nimble go-kart. And also the downforce. I mean, obviously, go-karts, you don't have any downforce or aero ability. And now in the Star Mazda cars, we have, you know, big wings and big downforce and high speed. So it's just, there's a lot to learn, and I'm still trying to learn as much as I can at a fast pace.
All racing drivers want to win. What is your goal in this Star Mazda series this year?
My goal definitely has to be to win. I mean, every driver wants to win, but you know, that winning comes with me being able to learn as much as I can as quick as possible. So if as long as I can get a lot of learning done in these first couple races and get some good points, and hopefully we'll be there at the end of the season to win the championship.
Formula One has to be the goal. What is your career path that you would like to do, let's say, for the next 3 years?
The next 3 years is kind of difficult. I mean, if I win this championship, then Mazda pays for me to drive in the Atlantic Championship. So, and it seems like that championship is on the rise again. So hopefully that would be a good thing for next year. And then after that, you know, I'd like to make the move to Europe. Hopefully this year I'll actually be able to start testing some F3 cars or something like that. And just kind of keep my foot over there and, you know, just start relationships with some people over there. So, you know, it all depends on how much I win and how well things go. So we'll see.
I'm sure Dad can open or at least introduce you to a lot of people. But let me ask you a question. Since your dad has been there, he probably won't buy any excuse from you. Do you sometimes feel like, man, I wish my dad was not a racing driver?
I don't know. He has a lot of information to offer, but you know, sometimes he does get on my nerves. I do admit, but you know, he's always there to help, and his advice is always very helpful. So you know, it's great to have him around.
Based on a little racing experience you had at Brands Hatch, when you race overseas, do you feel the difference in the level of aggression of the drivers? We're talking on the track, or the depth of the talent.
Well, I think America has a lot of talented drivers as well as Europe. It's just a different style of racing from country to country. But it's good. I'd say that the level of aggression is definitely different because of the different rules that they have over in Europe. I mean, there's obviously a lot of defensive driving allowed over in Europe, and in America here, not so much. So it was good for me to learn and get used to the defensive driving aspect and you know, it's really hardcore racing, really, is what it was. So, you know, it's great for me to, you know, put in my memory bank and learn for the rest of my life.
Okay, now I have a few questions. You have to give me one or the other, okay? Lewis Hamilton or Fernando Alonso?
That's a difficult one. I definitely like both people, but I think Lewis is who I'd like to see winning from now on.
Milka Duno or Danica Patrick?
Oh, Danica Patrick for sure. Danica, she's a good driver and a good looking girl as well.
Good. Now, the season is starting very soon. Formula One. What are your expectations?
Formula One will be definitely an interesting season with the new Ross Brawn GP team setting some quick times in testing. It'll be interesting to see how well they do in race pace, but. I mean, I can't wait to see the season start. I mean, the cars are a bit interesting looking, but it should be a good season.
And finally, how about a message for listeners of F1 Weekly Worldwide, please?
Oh, my website's www.connordaily.net. And, you know, hopefully everyone can see me progressing the motorsports ladder, and I hope to meet a lot of people along the way.
And don't forget the F1 Weekly and the poor people of Paris when you make it to Formula One.
Oh, I will definitely not forget.
It's now on record. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thank you.
Derek and Connor, thanks for joining F1Weekly.com. Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now as we go into the wrap-up, Nasser, we've got an email.
Yes, sir. This is from one of our regular listeners, Jeff Klein. And I remember this gentleman from his racing days. And he sent me an email and some very interesting experiences. And I just sent him an email. I says, man, the kind of experiences you have, I'm coming down to L.A. to talk to you. Very good stories. But he sent me this experience he had with Sir Stirling Moss. And this was at Goodwood. And I'm glad that he shared with us. And I would like you to read this in your broadcast voice, please.
Thank you, Nasser. The interview with Stirling Moss, his real character, really came through. I never spent much time with him, but in 2002, I was at Goodwood driving a C-type Jag and a 1937 Alpha 12C. And during one of the races that require two drivers, I was standing on the pit box looking down at Moss doing a driver change in a Cobra. He jumped in and buckled up, and just when he was pulling out of the pit, he unbuckled the belts and left with no seat belts operative. Marcus Pye and I just looked at each other in disbelief. Moss is one of a kind. Your interview was amazing. Thank you, Jeff. Keep up the good work. Of course, we'll go right to the San Francisco Formula One group. They're back in business. Check them out at sff1.com, and they'll be meeting at the Overtime Sports Bar and Grill Sunday, April 26th, 10 a.m. pre-race. The flag drops at 10:30 a.m., and of course, they're at 398 7th at Harrison in beautiful downtown San Francisco. And you can give them a call and check what's on the menu, 415-863-1688. Of course, the Jim Russell Northern California Rotax Challenge has got some more new stuff. The series news reports two Zamp helmets to be awarded to the 2009 Jim Russell Northern California Rotax Challenge racers by Robert Quinn Enterprises. So kudos to Robert Quinn. And of course, if you want to check out Marin Karting, go to www.marinkarting.com or call them. Area code 415-898-0999. We want to mention our MySpace, Facebook, and Twitter sites. Of course, do a search for F1 Weekly listeners, Clark Rogers, Nasser Hamid, or Steve Faub. We're there, and you can add us as a friend. If you'd like to advertise or cross-promote with our program, we're always looking for underwriters because it takes a lot of money to keep this flowing. So if you're interested in promoting what you make, give us a call or email us at info@F1Weekly.com. I want to thank all the listeners that make the show possible, and of course, the beautiful staff here at the palatial headquarters of F1Weekly.com. I want to thank Toby Dawes for doing an outstanding job keeping the website going. Of course, our executive producer, Mr. David Tapia, my co-host, Steve Faub, and of course, the man himself, Mr. Nasser Hamid. Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Desiree for F1Weekly.com. Thanking you, the subscribers and members of our listening audience, for listening to our podcast, reporting and commenting on Formula One, the highest echelon of motorsport, a blend of technology, tradition, glamour, and guts, all wrapped up in a high-speed package. That's F1Weekly.com for all your Formula One needs.